The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
Joining us now in studio, he managed to get over here without turning into an icicle. Patrick Chovanec, Chief Strategist at Silvercrest Asset Management. Patrick lived and worked for many years in China, back in the U.S. now, what, about a year and a half?
Yes, about a year now.
Yeah, well, about a year. And you've been coming on back on the show regularly. We appreciate that. I want to talk about China and your recent excellent piece, China's Train Running Out of Track, your Bloomberg View piece. But first, just a quick comment, Patrick, because you are, of course, chief strategist. You're watching everything now that's moving the markets. Jobs, ADP employment report, getting us ready for Friday. Should stocks be rising because maybe jobs are growing a little bit faster? Should they be stagnant or falling because if jobs are better, the Fed may taper faster?
Yes, that perverse thing that we saw all last year when good news was bad news because people were afraid that the Fed would taper. I mean, hopefully we're over that psychological barrier. I hope we're over that psychological barrier now that the Fed has begun tapering and that good news will be seen as good news again. You know, I think that there is some upside still to stocks. You know, if you look at it, there are a lot of people who are afraid that last year we saw sluggish growth and soaring stock prices, and that makes a lot of people nervous. But in fact, there have been years before in the early 80s, in the early 90s, when we did see stock market driven by PE valuations going up, which is what we saw last year. And that it wasn't a harbinger of doom. It was actually a harbinger of growth. And I hope that that's what's going to turn out to be the case now.
Well, what's your gut feeling?
Look, I think there's a lot of good news out of the U.S. economy, but it's not, you know, the thing that people are asking is where is demand? And their hope, I mean, the conventional economic wisdom says, well, if the demand isn't there, the government has to boost it. The government should be stimulating it. I think demand is going to come from a realignment in the global economy, that you're going to see a consumption story out of emerging markets, whereas before you saw a production story, and you're going to see a production story out of the U.S. The U.S. is not going to drive global consumption. And that realignment is going to be disruptive. It's going to be painful for some, but in the end, it's going to be positive.
Are you saying that we're seeing a little bit of a secular shift in the U.S., that people just won't consume as much anymore?
I think we're not going to go back to the world pre-2008, where the U.S. was the driver of consumption in the world, and the emerging markets drove production, and particularly China. We also had kind of a microcosm of that in Europe, where Germany drove production and the rest of Europe consumed. That's not sustainable. All too often, these kind of trade imbalances are discussed in terms of what's fair or unfair. I'm not concerned about what's fair or unfair. That things that are unfair can go on for a long time, but things that are unsustainable can't. And 2008 was a sign that the deficit countries of the world could no longer go into greater and greater debt to consume more than they produced. And so what we're going to see is an adjustment taking place where the surplus countries of the world, Germany and China, are going to go through a rebalancing.
Well, in fact, interesting that the trade balance report for November, United States, yesterday, just fell very sharply, what, $34 billion in change from just about, well, $39 billion the month before. Oil imports fell. This is a big U.S. story, right? But exports were like some of the strongest ever, right? So I think it plays to, 1 month does not the whole story make,
right,
but it plays to this shift you're talking about. And the rest of the world then perhaps, maybe not being able to rely quite so much on the U.S., to sell its goods to, because our imports maybe aren't going to be quite as strong.
Right. Some of it is a production story coming out of the United States because of the energy revolution, because of reshoring. Actually, there was an article recently about a Chinese textile manufacturer relocating to South Carolina, of all places. You wouldn't expect to see that. But some of it is also just the unlocking of demand in these emerging markets, particularly in China. I think it's going to be a very bumpy road to get there. Because this is a real dislocation of the economic growth
model
that we're
comfortable
with.
Why are you optimistic on Germany making this change? Because they have been stubborn exporters. They're more export dependent than the Chinese.
Yeah.
Where do you see that changing?
And why would they want to? Yeah. I mean, there's an argument for China wanting to. There's no real argument for Germany wanting to.
Well, you know, one thing I think is going to happen to Germany, Germany has been able to ignore the impact of austerity on European demand because they've been exporting to China and China's investment boom. As China's investment boom comes to an end, either abruptly or gradually, and I tend to think it'll come more abruptly than not, Germany's not going to be able to ignore the need for rebalancing within Europe. And I think it's going to change the dynamic of the discussion within Europe.
Jacob Lew, the Treasury Secretary, you know, is in Germany trying to tell them that they need to consume more and export.
That's going to go to, I bet that's really going to work too, Vani.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know, but Kathleen has a point. I mean, do we have any right to tell Germany that it needs to consume less?
Like I say, unfortunately, this usually gets framed in terms of fairness, and it really should be framed in terms of sustainability. All too often, there's the counter argument from the Germans and their supporters that say, this is all about competitiveness. Germany is more competitive. That's why it runs a trade surplus. Absolute competitive advantage doesn't translate into a trade surplus. Trade is all about comparative advantage.
Well, and they benefit from a weak euro. Their mark would have been much higher than the euro's.
Right. It's really about the savings rate, and it's about producing more than you consume because you're saving. And where has that savings gone? Unfortunately, that savings in Germany went to the periphery of Europe, and I don't think they're going to get it back.
Periodically last year, we had these scares of a cash crunch, a banking crisis in China. And again, the People's Bank of China a few days ago injecting about $55 billion into the market. Is there going to be some kind of crisis this year in China?
Well, we've just seen mounting signs that the foundations of China's investment boom is crumbling. We had a lot of people pointed in June when there was a credit crunch within the interbank lending system almost broke down. People thought that was a fluke. It happened again just near the end of December. And there's something happening here now. People are casting about, saying, "What is it? Is it Fed QE taper? Is it seasonal factors?" I think it's very clear. It's mounting bad debt within the Chinese system that's eating up the credit that's available, and more credit is going to roll over bad debt, and less of it is available to drive China's investment boom.
But it all comes from the state anyway, right? From the government? Mostly?
Sure, and they can debase their currency. I mean, the PBOC can inject more money anytime it wants and make this sort of temporarily go away. But it doesn't solve the underlying problem. And in fact, it feeds the underlying problem, which is more and more bad debt going into overinvestment.
Is it too much of an overstatement to say that just a few big investors are going to get hurt?
Look, a lot of people think, well, what does this have to do with me? I mean, if I'm not hugely exposed to China, how does it affect me? China's the second largest economy in the world. The world is largely insulated from China's financial system, and so it doesn't have any immediate financial impacts. But if you look at China's demand for commodities, right? It drives copper, it drives iron ore. If you look at the S&P 500, how many of those stocks have a lot of those companies have significant portions of the revenue or the earnings growth coming from China. Also, capital inflows into and out of China, particularly out of China. I think that's going to be a story regardless of whether there's a hard landing or a soft landing in China, more and more money leaving China. Well, we already see it. But if there's a hard landing, you could see significant amounts of money seeking a home outside of China.
Well, and that could be good for U.S. stocks.
It could be good for a lot of asset classes. I mean, right now, New York real estate or real estate in any kind of global entry point, you know, whether it's London or New York or L.A. or Vancouver or Sydney, the Chinese, I read a story the other day that said that over a quarter of new homes purchased in London last year were purchased by Chinese investors.
So in other words, wealthy Chinese who are worried about the same kinds of things you're worried about are trying to get money out of the country and put it in something that's more solid, hard asset.
Property is one thing that they feel comfortable with because they feel they're familiar with it. It seems tangible. But I think it's going to evolve into other things as
well.
So
what about the political ramifications of this? Because one of the big challenges for the new leadership, as you know better than anybody, having actually lived in China, is a population that is fed up with the corruption. And they are fed up with a bad air. And they're probably even wondering why they can't have a little more democracy like the rest of the world. So if this starts happening, what does this mean for the new leadership at such a critical point? Do they clamp down?
It's very challenging. And I think the leadership recognizes that they are on a runaway train, that they need to get off of it, that this is that the current growth model that they have is dead end. And that reform needs to take place and rebalancing needs to take place. But where to begin? And this attempt to rein in credit, or at least rein in the rapid rate of credit expansion, is what is the starting point, but it also is you get slower growth and you get defaults. And so every time that they try to do this, they shy back away from it. I mean, I think there is a certainly when you talk to people who, talk to the Chinese leadership and the feeling in China is that there's this big push for reform. But I think a lot of these reforms are going to be very tough to push through because they're going to mean real pain and real economic adjustment.
I'm still not sure that I'm convinced, though, that we're going to have some kind of, maybe not a banking crisis, but that there's going to be that the Chinese government is going to get into trouble in some way.
I think they're already in trouble in the sense that the model that they've been pushing, which is to have credit-fueled investment drive half or more of GDP growth, that's breaking down already. We see it in slower growth rates in China. We see it in these periodic cash crunches. I think we're already going through a process of this adjustment. It's unavoidable. But whether it turns into a market meltdown, look, I mean, in order to have a market meltdown, you need a market, and China
exactly.
is a funny kind of market. Mm. Now, but that doesn't mean
you
loss.
You may get some very wealthy Chinese people wiped out. But
you could have a situation like Japan, where the losses are all brushed under the rug, and you've got banks that sit on losses for a long time, but the losses are still real, and the result is a growth squeeze, and you get a lost decade or two. I think it would be much better, especially since China, the much bigger country, and even though it's surpassed Japan as the second largest economy in the world and is encountering all the kind of restrictions and constraints that implies, China has 10 times as many people. So the per capita GDP is one-tenth. They have a long way that they need to develop to satisfy everyone
China. We started this conversation talking about your view that China and Germany will have to start, they're going to start pulling away from exports. The Chinese admitted an explicit policy.
Right.
So as they turn to the consumer, is that... are they just going to have to put up with this tough time, or will the turn to the consumer maybe generate a little domestic demand so that there's some offset to what you see as a period of economic pain? You see slowdown, slower growth, maybe even contraction.
Well, and these two things are not incompatible because I think that what you're going to see is a slowdown in growth in China, but you're going to see resilient consumption. One of the good things that China has going for it is this $3.5 trillion worth of reserves. Now, there's a lot of misunderstanding about what that's good for. It's not good for boosting economic growth within China. It's not good for bailing out the banks within China. It is good for consuming more than they produce. For years, China's produced more than it has consumed. The Chinese can afford to consume more than they produce. So even if GDP falls significantly, the Chinese can continue to consume. They could even run a deficit. That would drive growth in the United States. That'd be a positive thing.
So it's a dark cloud, but it may have a silver lining. Patrick Chovanec, thank you so very much for joining us. Chief Strategist at Silvercrest Asset Management.
The Hayes Advantage, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern. In New York on Bloomberg 1130. In Boston on 1200 a.m. and 94.5 FM HD2. Or on Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 119. Copyright 2014, Bloomberg LP.